Hierdie inset word aan jou gebring met die komplimente van Radio Kaapse Kansel 729 AM. Besoek ons gerus by www.capepulpit.co.za. Baie welkom by Op Pad met Gilma. Vandag vat ons die pad en ja, ons gaan verry. So koop jy's reg, het jy 'n watertjie by en 'n hoed, sonhoed veral, met 'n bietjie sonskerm, want ons gaan in die veld inbeweeg. Ons is op pad na Morningstar toe, net op die N7 en daar gaan ons afdraai en by die Blouberg Natuurreservaat gaan ons stilhou. En daar gaan ons kyk na die slagting van Blouberg en die kundige Ray Fulagie gaan vir ons alles vertel. Ek is verskriklik opgewonde, moenie weggaan nie. Dominee Marius Breitenbach, NG predikant Stellenberg, maar ook 'n gekwalifiseerde argeoloog, is besig met verdere studies en toe ek by hom was in 'n vorige gesprek en 'n vorige program, het ek sommer vir hom gevra om my te vertel van die studies sodat ek het kan aansluit by die program wat ons dan gesê het ons gaan maak op die slag van Blouberg. Inderdaad is ons nou daar. Ek is op pad soontoe en ek wil intussen vir jou innooi in die gesprek in en Dominee Marius vertel vir ons 'n bietjie meer oor die agtergrond en die samewerking van hom en ander argeoloë om hierdie hele navorsingsprojek moontlik te maak.
Ons is so 3 wat tesisse daaroor geskryf het. Weereens, dit staan in geskiedenisboeke. So as jy oor die slag van Blouberg gaan lees, dan staan dit in geskiedenisboeke en daar gaan jy 'n klomp goed gaan kry. Argeologies kan hulle vir jou wys min of meer rigting daar. Maar waar precies was 'n ander storie. So, ons projek was op 3 maniere gewees. Ek het die, daar's 'n plaashuis, meneer Keer was sy naam. Dit was, daar was 'n plaashuis gestaan op die slagveld. En ek het die plaashuis ondersoek, want die plaashuis is omskep in 'n veldhospitaal. Net na die slag van Blouberg. So, ek het gefokus op die struktuur daar en die veldhospitaal en wat rondom die veldhospitaal gebly het. Willem Hatten, een van my collega's of vriende of wat ook 'n argeoloog is, het gefokus op die battle lines. Hy het die hele slag gaan ondersoek en hoe die twee lyne by mekaar gekom het en hoekom het die oorlog gebeur en waar die oorlog gebeur. Maar ons het fisies gegaan met metaalverklikkers en dan vir 2-3 jaar elke liewe Saterdag gegaan en gestap en gaan opgrawe en gaan gesien hoe die lyne gelyk. So jy kan sien die knopies wat af is, wie was hier gewees, is dit Franse, was dit dalk van die plaaslike mense gewees, maar jy kan ook sien waar mense doodgeskiet is, waar mense gesterf het, uit wat geweer het, wat het koel gekom, of ons noem die musketpols. So ons het daai lyne gaan trek en fisies die trajecties het hulle gaan trek van hoe die goed geloop het om die slag te rekonstrueer. Nie net volgens die geskiedenisboeke nie, maar volgens dit wat ons op die grond kry. François het ook navorsing gedoen. Hulle het geland mos nou in Melkbosstrand. So net gou-gou, dis 'n geheime sending gewees. Dit is een van die grootste sendings wat ooit die geskiedenis uitgestuur is. Iets 50 of 60 skepe. Maar onthou gou-gou, in daai tyd was daar 'n oorlog aan die gang, né? Tussen Engeland en die Franse. So daar was 'n groot oorlog in Engeland aan die gang of in daai gedeeltes en hulle het in geheimhouding 50 skepe onttrek en hulle het gerandewoon en mekaar iewers gekry in die oseaan en afgetrek. So stel jouself voor, ons het ken nie vandag so iets nie. Jy word een oggend wakker en daar's 50 oorlogskepe wat aankom. En so hulle het hier aangekom en toe gebaai ons geliefde Suidoos. So dis 'n probleem. Hulle kan nie aan wal kom nie, want die plan vir 3 jaar uitgewerk of 2 jaar, ons gaan nou die Kaap inneem, want ons wil die Kaap beset, want hulle daar kom toe waar die Suidoos. Hulle kon nie naby die kasteel kom nie, want dit was binne die reikwydte van die kanonne gewees. En dis die dat hulle toe uitgewyk het na die Blouberg omgewing. So ek het, waar kan ons nie daar 'n baadjie kry nie, is 'n veiliger baadjie. En toe het hulle van die skepe op laat strand om 'n breek te maak vir die branders, dat hulle aan die ander kant kan ingaan. Natuurlik toe hulle die eerste keer probeer het, toe hulle gepot deur die ouens wat in bossies gaan wegkruip en hulle skiet van die wal af, maar daar het hulle aan wal gekom. Ons praat van duisende soldate, Engelse soldate wat in die hitte, meeste van hulle is dood van uitputting. So van daar af het hulle toe net die kort enkie, so waar die ATKV, denk ek, terrein op Melkbosstrand is. Hy sit so net so aan die kant van die dorp. Daar is so 'n terreinkie daar. Dis waar hulle gekamp het. Daar en waar die golfbaan is, Atlantic Beach, dis waar hulle kamp was. Duisende soldate wat aan wal gekom en hulle het oor die koppietjie getrek van Blouberg en van die ander kant af het die Bataafse Jansens gekom. Dis generaal Beert en Jansens en hulle het net agter daai berg dan beklei. Vir die eerste paar kere net kanonne geskiet oor afstand van 700 tot 900 meter aan mekaar en toe dis die enigste veldslag, Napoleonse veldslag. So wat jy doen is jy doedelsakke, helder rooi klere, helder knopies, vere in jou, jy wil hulle bang maak. So het hulle na mekaar toe aangemarseer en die laaste paar meter is daai bloedige een, jy kan nie meer skiet nie. Jy sit die bajonet op en dan hardloop jy en dan is dit hand tot hand geveg. So ons kan dit sien gebeur op die grond. Maar daai navorsingsstukke is op die internet beskikbaar. Julle kan ons teses daar gaan lees en julle kan die stories daar gaan lees. Dit is vir die publiek beskikbaar.
Dis nou interessant as jy nou so praat van hierdie besonderse slag, maar net te luister na wat jy sê, dan besef vir mense net die impak daarvan moet eintlik baie meer vertel word.
Daar is mense wat nou 'n boek daaroor gepubliseer het, nou onlangs baie goeie navorsing daaroor gedoen. Maar dis 'n storie wat niemand van weet nie. Ons kinders weet nie daarvan nie, baie mense weet nie daarvan nie, hulle het iets daarvan gehoor. Maar onthou, dis 'n gebeurtenis wat ons land verander het. Dis toe die Kaap ingeneem is deur die Engelse. Van daar af het ons geskiedenis gedraai en dis die enigste, weer eens, Napoleonse oorlog wat suid van die Sahara ooit beklei is. So, dit is baie belangrik en ek dink ons het genoeg gedoen om daai gebeurtenis weer te kan uitlig en in geskiedenis te kan, in perspektief te kan stel.
Vir jou wat saam met my reis en op pad met Gilma, die kundige met wie ek vandag gesels, dominee Marius Breitenbach, hy is eintlik NG predikant van Stellenberg, maar weliswaar ook 'n argeoloog in sy eie reg, so baie dankie vir jou tyd vandag, groot voorreg. Dominee, as mense nou wil kontak maak, hulle stel belang in hierdie aspekte, dalk is daar 'n plaas ergens wat ook wil hulle deel doen om ons geskiedenis te verewig hier in die omgewing, kan hulle kom kers vashou by jou?
Ja, onthou gou, dit is my inligting kry ek van gewone mense, want iewers het jou familie iewers 'n verbintenis miskien met een van hierdie plase of so. Ek asseblief, mense is welkom my enige tyd. Dit is nou maklik, jy gaan net na die NG Kerk Stellenberg se webruimte toe. Jy sal my besonderhede daar kan kry. Jy kan vir my e-pos of vir my skakel. Maar ek weet hier's baie mense wat inligting het, wat waardevol is. So ons probeer regtig die storie vertel deur almal se stories ook te kan kry. So as jy enige verbintenis het met een van hierdie plase of enige foto's het, interessant, dis baie belangrik wat ons nie het nie, deel dit asseblief met ons.
Baie dankie vir die tyd. Sterkte met die navorsing. Now we listened to Maurice telling about the hospital and where it was on the farm. But one man that was in and around that area quite a lot was Henry Martijn. He was born on 18 February 1781 to 16 October 1812. And he was an Anglican priest and missionary that was on board of the ship. And he then went onto the battlefield and I would like to quote some of the material that he wrote on this specific battle, also mentioning the hospital. Now, in his journal on 8 January 1806, he wrote, "A most tremendous fire of artillery behind a mountain abreast of the ship just after 7 the morning. Soon thereafter, he goes ashore and accompanies some English soldiers to the battle site. Crossing over a hill to the east of Blouberg, he described the scene he sees as he looked down on the battle plain. The ground then opened into the most extensive plain, which extended from the sea to the Blue Mountains. On the right was the little hill to which we were attracted by seeing some English soldiers. We found that there were some wounded men on the 24th. They had all been taken care of by the surgeon of the staff. 3 were mortally wounded. We then descended into the plain where the two armies had been drawn up. They gave me a full account of the position of the armies and particulars of the battle. We soon met with some of the 59th, one of the corporals who often joins us in singing and who gave the pleasing intelligence that the regiment had escaped unhurt, except Captain McPherson. I went down to the valley belonging to the burgher Justice Nicholas Keir, which we had converted into a respectable for the sick, and in which there were already 200 English, with a few of the enemy. Here I entered and found that 6 officers were wounded, but as the surgeon said, they should not be disturbed. I did not go in, especially as they were not dangerously wounded. In one room I found a Dutch captain wounded, with whom I had a good deal of conversation in French. In the rear of the enemy army there were some farmhouses. After I found an opportunity of retiring and lay down amongst the bushes, I lifted up my soul to God. I cast my eyes over the plain, which a few hours before had been the scene of bloodshed and death, and mourns over the dreadful effect of sin. How reviving to my thoughts were the Blue Mountains on the east, where I conceived the missionaries labouring to spread the gospel of peace and I. Now Henry Martijn died on 16 October 1812. The Henry Martijn Centre began in 1992, and today the centre continues to seek to promote the study of mission and world Christianity, developing strong links with mission study centres around the world and fulfilling the same aim stated by the founder of the library in 1897. Ons is op pad na Gilma, ja, en ons is hier in die veld, ons is by die Blouberg Natuurreservaat, en onder die kundige leiding van Roy Fulagie, hy is van die Friends of Blouberg Conservation Area, gaan ons ook vir jou alles vertel rondom hierdie unieke gebeurtenis en die invloed wat het gehad het op ons hier in die Kaap. En op die groote Suid-Afrika. Thank you for joining me here at Op Pad met Gilma. It's quite a unique experience because we're actually standing on a reserve, the Blouberg Reserve. And this is very significant because we are going to talk about the Battle of Blouberg. And remember I told you that we are because everything referred back to this. Roy Fulagie is standing here next to me. You've got such an important role to play and thank you so much for allowing me into this beautiful reserve.
It's only a pleasure. I've been a founder member of the Friends of Blouberg Conservation since 2002, when this land was not under protection, and the city had this plan of acquiring a corridor of land between Tableview and Melkbosstrand to conserve for the people. And so the concept was Blouberg Conservation Area, and it's now formally protected as a Blouberg Nature Reserve. That's a provincial protection. It's also got a provincial heritage overlay protection as well. So this land will never be developed for housing. And the true value of it is that it has 3 vegetation types within the reserve. The coast has a specific vegetation, dune thicket vegetation. Then we have rhinosterveld vegetation on the hill. And here we're standing on a major international project for the sandplain restoration, sandplain fynbos restoration. And this has been a project that has been going since at least 2010. In 2013, international funding came and we were able to clear 100 hectares of this alien vegetation, which we call Port Jackson in South Africa. It came from Australia. It was brought here many, many years ago. The Department of Agriculture encouraged farmers to grow it, but it was used to stabilize the sand that was drifting on the Cape Flats. And unfortunately, it has overtaken and overgrown the natural vegetation. So here, the sandplain fynbos restoration area has less than 1% in existence.
Wow.
And about 6%, 0.6% under conservation. And so we are trying, the city has been working with international partners and researchers at Stellenbosch University are continuing the research on how to remove the alien vegetation and how to restore and, in fact, re-establish or vegetation species that should be in this area. But it is critically important to tell you about the biodiversity value of Blaubeek Nature Reserve.
Now, talking about this very important conservation area, everything we talk about is heritage. Heritage is also plant species. Have you got enough seedlings to re-establish?
No. In fact, if you look at our badge, we have the natural heritage and we have the cultural heritage. As you quite rightly point out, the natural heritage, the biodiversity, is disappearing fast. And we know about this. Climate change is going to make big differences to it. And it's disappearing before we know about some of the plants themselves. Do we have plants to plant? No, we don't. This is why we are actually collecting seeds. We have in the past collected seeds from within the reserve to repropagate. Part of the research projects have been is how critical the temperature of fire was. As everyone knows, fire is important for Cape Fynbos. And the other aspect is the smoke. Some seeds obviously get destroyed by heat, and other seeds require the smoke influence. What is the balance? And that's part of the research that has been taking place. There's lots of papers been done on it, and it's of world importance. And it's taken place here in Blaubeek Nature Reserve. We're very fortunate that we're now expanding the restoration southwards. Now we started with 100 hectares, as I say, from the international funding, but it is very expensive, and this is what people don't perhaps appreciate. To remove alien vegetation is a cost. The maintenance follow-up, annual follow-up, to remove these seeds from these Port Jackson seeds that remain in the soil, they may be here another 100 years. And part of the research project was what is the best method of cutting and burning this vegetation. And so that was even so important for the researchers and for other people who have this on their land, is how best to deal with the cut vegetation, the alien vegetation.
If people want to find out more about your progress, about what you are doing regarding this, what would be the best way to inquire?
Okay, we do have a website. It's bca.org.za. If you go onto our website, you'll find that there's a lot. It's a very easy to use website, and you'll find various topics on the left hand side of the opening page. And you'll see that we also put research, we put archaeological papers on there as well, we put articles on there. So there's a wealth of information, and you can download it. And if you want to know more, you know, I think the important thing is to come and see it yourself and then get the information to enhance
your passion.
Thank
you for joining me here on the Blaubeek Reserve. Roy Fulagi is standing here next to me, next to a cannon. Can you tell me a little bit more about it?
Yes, I can. One of our members, Ian Van Oort, who was the person who worked with me in 2013 on establishing where the battlefield was, and from that went the archaeology. He was a member of the Cannon Association, and he restored cannons and built replicas. And in the lockdown, he finally got to put his manuscript for his book, which is the best and most detailed book about the Batavians and the English and the whole reason behind this battle. But this cannon he bequeathed to us, because unfortunately in the COVID lockdown he also found out that he had some health issues, and now he has cancer. And so he's bequeathed this to the Friends of Blaubeek Conservation to be displayed in the battlefield site. So we've been given this cannon. It's going to be restored by the Cannon Association. The cannon carriage, you can see it's stood outside for some time. It needs a bit of repair. So the Cannon Association are going to be collecting this and repairing it, and then bringing it back, painted in bright red, which would have been its color on board a ship. And then the cannon will be put on a platform which is my next project, is to build a platform. I've made those scrape marks
there.
Oh,
yes, I see.
Where we want to lift it up and put it in a position of dignity. At the moment, it's had to be dropped here on a hard surface. We're not allowed to put it into the vegetation. So this is its final resting place. It's the first symbol in this whole region that a battle took place here.
My goodness.
There is no sign anywhere that indicates that the Battle of Blouberg occurred in Blouberg.
There's an interesting story as to where this cannon was found.
What happened is that these cannons, after their useful life, whether they were British or cannons that had come from other European countries, when they were no longer needed, they were often used as posts around car parks, and the Grand Parade certainly had a lot of these around, and they were put into the ground vertically. And the big knob end, if I can call it that, without being rude, was used to harness your horse's reins so your horse or your carriage could stay where it was supposed to stay. So you can actually see wear marks on this cannon where the leather harnesses have worn it. But this cannon was dug up from under a road in central Cape Town in 2001. Ian van Oort was given the ownership of it to restore it, which he did. And then he built the carriage as well to put it. And it is actually a firing cannon. After the Cannon Association have done its restoration, they will do a test firing, and on the 14th of January, this cannon will be fired again on the battlefield. It'll be the first cannon on this site. It is the first cannon on this site for more than 218 years.
Oh.
Okay, and in January, it'll be fired. It'll be the first major cannon shot. We've had smaller cannons here for starts of races and things like that, but it'll be the first big caliber gun fired here. A muzzle loader that is back on the battlefield.
We're standing here. If there's a little bit of wind noise in our conversations, there's just no other way we can talk to you and explain to you things if we're not standing here literally overlooking the battlefield. A very interesting thing is the original route of the VOC also went through here.
Yes, absolutely. If you think back to the VOC company, they had to go out of Cape Town, the castle area, to trade and also to grow crops and grow livestock. And one of the main routes to the west coast came through Blouberg Nature Reserve. The track is still visible now. We know where it is. And this is exactly why the Battle of Blouberg occurred at this location. But this route took travelers and livestock farmers through this area into the west coast, into the it was referred to as the Slachtersveld. I'm sure you got some of that from Marius Breitenbach. But it was a critical area for the livestock, the cattle and the goats and the sheep that they needed, and also to grow wheat. So this was a route that has disappeared over time because we've established the R27, the coast road, and obviously the N7. But this is a predecessor. This is when wagons used to travel through this land, and horses and cattle in small herds. What I wanted to mention while we're standing here, before we get into the more recent 215 years of history, we're standing on one of the few Silk Route ridges. This was very important for the pre-colonial people, the San, the Khoi. You can see when this rock shatters, it produces
sharp edges.
And so this would have been used for scraping tools, cutting tools, even arrowheads.
Yeah.
Just chip it and it'll make a nice sharp edge again.
Are there a lot of indications of pre-200 years of habitation?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the point is that we have found here arrowheads, scraping tools, dotted all over the landscape. We know that of the water holes, the historic water holes, there's evidence there, obviously, of habitation. When we spoke about the coastal zone, the strandloopers, if you want to call them the Prisan, there are more than 100 burial sites that have been dug up, especially through development in Malpa Strand. It often happens that they're putting in a swimming pool, and as they excavate, they come across skeletons, and then they have to call the archaeologist, who then has to establish if it's recent, which would be a police crime. Saps are normally pulled in immediately if you found human bones. And then the archaeologist would determine whether it was a bushman or a strandlooper burial. And there's plenty of evidence in this area. And this dates back, you know, tens of thousands of years.
You mentioned something about a very important archaeological site from where we stand. What have you discovered?
Okay, what I would, I'm going to tell you now is that we are overlooking the Battle of Blobeg.
Yeah.
Where the British came here in 1806. This was the second invasion. People often forget that the British came here in 1795 and took the Cape from the Dutch East India Company, the VOC. That was the Battle of Muizenberg. And this was all part of the European wars, the Napoleonic Wars between the British and the French. And there was a cessation in the fighting in Europe, and the countries had to give back the land or the properties that they had taken from their enemies. And the Cape was given back to, not the VOC, because the VOC unfortunately had gone bankrupt in that period of time. The agreement was given to hand back the Cape to the Dutch. Okay, the Dutch at that stage were under the control of the French Napoleonic Empire, and they were called the Batavian Republic. So people are confused about who fought here. Well, it was Cape Town was controlled by the Batavian Republic from Netherlands. And at this battle, when I described, there was people from Java, there was people from Holland, there were people from Germany, there were people from Hungary, and there was a regiment of what they called the Hottentot Infantry. These were the Khoisan people that were called up, should we say, to fight for the Batavians, and they were used in many of their skirmishes, the border wars. But they were based here at Reedflay, or the families were based there, and they were one of the regiments that fought here to defend their country against this second invasion on the 8th of January 1806. So if I can just describe what happened leading up to mm-hmm. the battle now. So about 63 ships left the United Kingdom under secrecy, because at that stage the British were expecting an invasion from France of Britain. And so they sent this fleet to the Cape to take the Cape to prevent the French from controlling the trade route to India and to China and the spice trade to Indonesia and the like. So this fleet left in about August of 1805, and they sailed south via South America. They had to replenish, and they had to try to get some horses for the British cavalry. They eventually arrived here in the Cape on the 3rd of January. By then, Janssen, who was in charge of the Cape colony, he knew that the fleet was coming, but he didn't know where they were going to invade or land, whether they were going to go back to Muizenberg, they were going to go to Simonstown, whether they were going to Saldanha, whether they were going to land elsewhere. But their fleet moored between the current Malpa Strand and Robben Island. So you imagine looking out from the castle and seeing 63 sailing ships, big sailing ships, anchored off the coast, and not knowing where they were going to finally land the troops. By the 6th of January, the troops had started to disembark from the ships that were moored off Malpa Strand. And in the next 2 days, 5,500 British troops were landed at Malpa. They didn't have horses for the cavalry, so nine ships, whether it was eight or nine, departed from the fleet and went up to Saldanha to land the cavalry there and another regiment. And they were to march south from Saldanha, collecting horses for the British cavalry. And that's a sad story, because they didn't. Not only didn't they collect enough horses for the cavalry, but it was a very exhausting walk. And cavalry like to ride horses, they don't like to walk, and they really suffered. But they got here too late anyway for the battle. So on the 8th of January, if you think how uncertain it was for Janssen, he could only bring out about 2,000 defenders from the castle. On the 7th, he arrived in the plain, which we can see to the south now. His intention was to march up this road, this VOC R27 of the day, up to the surrounding hills and defend the Cape and keep the British soldiers on the beach.
Which would probably have been the best
solution. He knew he couldn't defeat the British, but he was trying to delay the British long enough for the French to send reinforcements to the Cape.
Okay.
But little did he know, because we didn't have CNN in those days, that the Battle of Trafalgar had taken place before the end of 1805, and Nelson had defeated and destroyed the French fleet. So there was no capacity for the French to send ships to relieve the Cape and soldiers, because they were in a European war. So poor old Janssen, he didn't know. He was the only defense that was going to happen for the Cape. Anyway, so the morning of the 8th, at 4 o'clock in the morning, he looked north, ready to march his soldiers to the hills, and already he could see the British redcoats coming through. Wow. Now, the 1st Brigade came through between Blaubeek Hill and what we called Rondekop, and there was about 2,500 redcoats that were starting to march.
Oh, man, you would be able to see them, because redcoats are obvious.
Very obvious. And the Highland regiments, who were the 2nd Brigade, marched immediately inland and came south on this road. So there were another 2,000 soldiers coming into the plain. And so where we stand now, you have to imagine that there were three regiments of Highland soldiers on our east side, all getting into their Napoleonic system of fighting, which was in...
It's like, what do you call it, formation fighting.
Formations, exactly. So they would have been in rows next to each other as well. And then on our west side, you would have seen the other British regiments getting into their formation.
They were all fighting at that stage in formation, all of them.
Yes, this is the largest and probably the only Napoleonic-style battle fought in South Africa, for sure. And I don't want to be flippant, but it was a lesson to the British that when they came, this battle was fought in that style, where the combatants lined up against each other and had this very strange thing of firing a shot and then kneeling, and then the next guy would fire a shot and then they would reload and do the same and advance. Well, it worked here, but after this battle, when you think about what happened in the history of South Africa, where they were fighting against the Zulus, they didn't understand this formation fighting. And certainly with the Boer War, the South African War, there was never going to be any people standing and shooting at each other openly.
I read once that they said that the Bush War tactics were developed at that stage by the people of South Africa, different groups.
Yes.
And I think, well, we are innovative in that way.
Well, absolutely. No, the all the wars that have been fought in Europe and in North America, because we have to remember that the British lost very important colony of America before this battle, within 30 years of this Battle of Blaubeek. And there they fought the conventional war, but the Americans also introduced this guerrilla warfare. And certainly later, within 100 years of this battle, you know, we know the Boer commando system, which has been adopted. I mean, the British commandos are based on the tactics that was fought here in the South African wars.
I have to be honest with you, standing here imagining all of this, it must have been incredibly impressive.
Oh, it must have been awe-inspiring. It must have been devastating for the defenders to see they were outnumbered 2-1.
Sure.
So if I can just point you to the south now. There's blue gum trees over there, and there's blue gum trees directly south of us.
Yeah.
In the middle, there's a clearing.
Yes.
Okay, that clearing is where the first outspan was, the Blouberg Valley outspan, which was the first outspan outside of the VOC territory. The Rietvlei was the last outpost for the VOC. So this was under the franchise, if I can call it that, of somebody called Justinus Kier. That's where the Batavian forces under Janssen had collected on the 7th. And then when he saw his advantage was lost to march further north, he then put his troops in line formation across the valley.
Mm.
Now, we can't see it today, but there's loose sand dunes here to the right towards what we see, Table Mountain, and on the left.
Yeah.
So this area of the road was the only area that he could defend.
Yeah.
He did send some Burger cavalry to Claremont, and he also sent the sharpshooters there as well. There was a skirmish there with the 24th Regiment. The British sent this regiment over to establish exactly whether there was further troops behind that hill. There was a skirmish there. Now, the 24th went on to win more Victoria Crosses than I think any other regiment has ever done in history at Rooik's Drift in the Zulu War.
Yes.
So they have a long history in South Africa from 1806 to the Zulu Wars, shall we call it. Anyway, so what had happened by this stage, by about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, the troops had lined up. The British had managed to bring some cannon to this location where we're standing. And they started firing the howitzers at the middle of the line of the defensive Batavian troops. And after the first salvos, the troops, the regiment was the 5th Waldeckers. They were mercenaries from Germany and from Hungary.
Sure.
And they lost about 30% of their troops in the first barrage of howitzers. The Highlanders had been marching south, and they were being attacked intensively by the Batavian artillery. They lost a lot of troops. And eventually, when they got into closer contact, they fired a volley at the Batavian defensive line. The Waldeckers had already retreated, and the bayonets were attached to the rifles of the Highlanders, and they charged the defensive line.
Sure.
Once the Waldeckers had pulled out, the imminent defeat was going to take place. So Janssen instructed his soldiers to retreat to Rietvlei. They would assemble there and make a decision as to where they were going to go from then.
You know, it's actually quite sad thinking that such an incredible loss of life actually happened here. And here we stand how many years later?
Well, as I say, it was 1806. In 2016, we celebrated or remembered the 210-year anniversary. So we are now 8 years later, so it's 218 years ago.
How do you manage to know exactly where everything happened? How well has this been documented?
Okay, well, what happened in 2013, we had invited the author of this book, Willem Steenkamp, to give a presentation on Blouberg Hill. And we had about 55 people who attended that meeting. We have to restrict the numbers because of the space and the parking. Mm. But he presented, gave his presentation, which was the first time I'd heard him speak, and he was, his ancestor was involved with this battle from Swellendam Dragoons. So he had a family history, should we say, involved with this battle. But afterwards, when we were talking about where the battle had occurred, there was some confusion. So at that stage, I had asked for volunteers to help me, and we would go around the battle site here to find evidence. And fortunately for us, that was in 2013, January. By February, we had discovered a lot of evidence of the route, and also we had found that there had been previous research in the 90s where artifacts had been found at that Justinus Kier's outspan. Now, the outspan was used as the military hospital for 10 days after the battle to treat the hundreds of wounded soldiers on both sides. So what was not known is exactly where the Batavian line was. We knew the British came, from which direction they came to march. It was all logical. There were maps that showed great detail. But many of the maps that were done by the British after the battle did not show why the British 1st Brigade came behind the 2nd Brigade into the battle. And it's only with the evidence of the clearing, this research, that we, restoration I was telling you about, they had burnt this, cleared this first 100 hectares. These sand dunes became evident. If you can imagine soldiers who've got their full kit on them, they've been at sea for 5 months, they've had a 7K walk to this site, they're now going to march south, and they're faced with those tall sand dunes. You can't see how big they are, but they're at least 20 feet tall, or 7 meters. So they were delayed, so that's why they had to come behind the, many of them, the 1st Brigade came behind the Highland regiments, and they didn't actually get involved with the hand-to-hand combat. But so this restoration project gave us an early idea as to some of what might have taken place on 8th of January 1806. But then we had to get archaeologists, we had to get permits to actually research the archaeology. And we were very fortunate that the City of Cape Town archaeologist Harriet Clift, she assisted us and she introduced us to one of the senior lecturers at the University of Cape Town archaeology department, Louisa Hutton. And they were looking for a project. They had a student who was wanted to do a battlefield project. And, you know, the obvious battlefields were Zululand, or in the Free State, or in the Transvaal, wherever, as we call it then. So they did. She wasn't aware that the Battle of Blobeck had taken place. So we started the archaeology project. The first project was done by her husband, who was wanting to do his honours, and that was to actually locate the artillery position here, which we did. He then had to apply for another permit to do his master's, which was actually to establish where the Batavian battle line was. And then Marius Breitenbach, who you've interviewed, he wanted to establish the exact location of this outspan, this small building that was used as a military hospital. So he did his honours on locating it, and then his master's on actually the excavation of the building that no longer exists today. And then we had another archaeologist who did a project on where the British were bivouacked, or where they slept, should we say, after their landing. So he did a project on that at Melkbosch Strand. So we, out of this research, we have 5 archaeological degrees.
Wow.
So we know exactly what happened on this battlefield 218 years ago. We found evidence. We've got plenty of collection of musket balls, cannon fragments, buttons, coins, buckles, horse harness pieces. So there's an incredible collection, and it's a thesis that's on our website, The Masters by Willem Hutton. And anyone who really wants to understand how you find out and how you establish what happened on a battlefield 218 years ago, Read that. It's got some fantastic maps that can tell you why we suspected that the battle was fought in that location. And then he's got all the maps of the artifacts. So you can see on the battlefield that all the musket balls were found in this location or not.
Sure. All those artifacts, where are they kept?
All the artifacts, well, the original art collection from the 1990s is with the Friends of Blobe Conservation Area, but the rest of the artifacts are under the care of Zico Museum.
Okay.
As official repository. We have nowhere to display it. We would like to be able to display many of the artifacts. We do display our small collection, smaller, but it is representative. The anniversary events and other times we bring the public in or can bring the public in to present to them the Battle of Blobeck.
Oh, well, we're going to tell you all about this event that we are speaking about, but I suppose we're going to go up the mountain now.
Yeah, I want your eyes to pop out. I want you to see this view and really be shocked that you didn't know about this location.
Well, we're standing on top of Blobeck Hill with the most spectacular 360 degrees view, which I will post, and a total different view of the mountain and of Robben Island. And I'm just so gobsmacked. It's just so beautiful. I can't even find the words. Now, let's talk about the uniqueness of where we are standing.
If you imagine that road that we've come up now was only built in after 1939, then the Defence Force realised they had to put some facilities on Blobeck Hill. So we're standing now on the deck that was built for visitors at the mess room. This is used to be where they used to come and eat, and the breakfast, lunches and suppers, I guess. Now, the building to our right with a scalloped roof was the artillery observation post. In there was a powerful range-finding telescope. There was cannon at Greenpoint, cannon on Robben Island. The cannons in Robben Island are still there. They're huge cannon, so they couldn't be removed. Now, in the Second World War, obviously, there was the German ships coming around the Cape, the submarines and the raiders, as they call them. And there could be, and there was, Japanese also submarines that came this far. And the British sent out schematics to the South African Defence Force on a radar station. Radar was top secret. It was the secret weapon that the British had against the Germans in the Second World War with the Battle of Britain. And they sent the schematic out because it was so secret. But an engineer, I can't give you his name offhand, who worked for Eskom, built out of radio ham parts a radar unit, and it was located right here. This is the first radar station in South Africa. So after the British realized that the South Africans could build a radar unit from literally drawings of the principles of a radar unit, they then sent out 24 fully operational radar units, and our second radar station on Blobeck Hill was in the building just further south on the slope here. You'll see it's a flat roof building. If you walk in there, you'll see the room on the left has a hole in the roof and a metal frame on the floor, and that frame holds the electronics for the radar unit. In the right-hand room was a map table of Table Bay. So if you've seen war movies of the Battle of Blobeck, they had these map rooms where ladies normally, with sticks, moving little Monopoly ships around on the map to indicate where the ships were, the airplanes coming over from France and from Europe. So if you've got that in your mind, you can imagine that radar station down there. There would have been ladies from the secret signal squadron. They were mainly university students, 17, 18-year-old ladies, who ran the radar unit, and they also lived on the hill. Separate from the artillery observation, the soldier men presumably there. But they would obviously meet at this mess room. So the artillery observation post would get information from the radar unit, which would be, all the information was sent to the castle, by the way, from the different radar units. And from there, they would make decisions on how to deploy the ships and the airplanes and whatever that the South African Defence Force had then. So from the Second World War, these buildings have existed. In 1954, they decommissioned, the military pulled out and sold everything. So these buildings were derelict when the city of Cape Town purchased the land that Blobec Hill is on, which was the first step in the establishment of what is now Blobec Nature Reserve and the coastal strip, which we'll talk about now. So these buildings have all been restored by the city of Cape Town. This accommodation here is approved to sleep four people. So you'll see there's two single beds and bunk beds. And the public can book this accommodation on our website, which is bca.org.za. You'll look and see there's a tab accommodation. You click on that, it'll tell you all the information, the inventory. Everything, all your cutlery, crockery, bedding is provided. You have to bring your food and your briquettes. There's a little Weber here as well, a mobile Weber, which you can cook your favorite braai or bring a picnic. We often picnic up here when there's no visitors using the accommodation.
Well, we're fortunate we have the full access of this area, which I'm really, really thankful for.
So all of this land belonged to the Department of Agriculture. So Cape Nature used to administer it. And then when the city of Cape Town established this need for this conservation area, the management was given from Cape Nature to the city of Cape Town Biodiversity Management. So the Blobec Nature Reserve runs from the beach through to the first gate.
It's quite big.
Yeah, and there's also little patches of Melpos which have conserved as well. So they're getting close to 2,000 hectares under management.
That's wonderful.
Unfortunately, the northern slopes of this hill, you'll see a fenced line, and that pasture there belonged to the International Pentecostal Holiness Church, who purchased that for $210 million. The city was prepared, which was a fair market price of around $10 to $12 million, to buy that to integrate into the Blobec Nature Reserve. Unfortunately, this church, International Pentecostal Holiness, from Soweto, they bought it to have a pilgrimage site here. So, you know, like the Zionist church, they wanted a mass pilgrimage site. And unfortunately, we are not able to get that land integrated into Blobec Nature Reserve, which is a great pity because they're not allowed to develop it.
Okay, so at least
it's safe from development. Yes, they've infringed once and they won't do it again. That's the brief history of that land. And you can see the pastures they tried to establish before the church bought the land. So they were going to try to plant wheat here and establish it as a functional farm instead of a dormant farm, which obviously affected the value of the land.
Yeah. Sure. This is really a very interesting place, a beautiful view that we have here of what would have been their arrival onto the beach on the Battle of Blobec.
You can imagine now, Robben Island to Malpa Strand. There was a fleet, the largest invasion in the Southern Hemisphere until the Second World War occurred here at Blobec. But you imagine those sail ships. It must have been an incredible sight. Oh, for the residents of Cape Town, must have been very intimidating. They could have obviously, you know, bombarded Cape Town, but that wasn't the intention of the British to destroy the infrastructure. They wanted to, you know, obviously keep it as a functional port and replenishment station. The ships were moored, and the little flatboat landing craft had to go from the beach to each ship collecting the troops and come back to the little safe landing area at Melkbos Strand. There was a tragedy. One boat flipped as it came around the natural reef there, and all 37 on board that boat sunk to the bottom like lead weights because they had all their gear on them. And I think only three of the bodies were ever discovered, ever found. But there's still artifacts underneath the water there in the sand, I'm sure. They would have had coins on them, yes, but not to justify the expense of an archaeological or a recovery. But we have to remember this event because this is the turning point for South Africa and for Africa. I think people tend to forget that this wasn't a colony. The Batavians, the Dutch, never had a plan to have a colony here. It was just a replenishment station. Their incursions into the hinterland, including what we call the Slachtersveld out there, was only to provide enough food and product to service the ships that were coming in here on their way to India or on the way to Indonesia, which was the Dutch possession. So they had never plans for colonization of South Africa. When the British came here, they had no plans also. I don't think the initial intention was that. But as we all know, it changed the course of history of South Africa. Within the next 80 years of this battle, the migration of the first Europeans to have come to the Cape started migrating north, you know, to establish the Free Strait and the Transvaal, and then went into what is now KwaZulu-Natal. Those caused battles of their own, hostility. Then by the end of the 1800s became the battles between the British and, I'm not sure if you still call them Boers, but the mixed Europeans that migrated north. And those were the South African, what is politely called now the South African Wars rather than the Boer War, between the British and the Afrikaners. So in the 100-year anniversary of Battle of Blobeck, it was at the time after the Boer War had been resolved and the British had taken over the whole of South Africa. And so it was never remembered. It wasn't remembered again until 2004 when historians started saying, there was a Battle of Blobeck. It's, you know, politically we should not be celebrating. But we must remember, this is the beginning of colonization, not Jan van Riebeck. Mm. And a lot of our politicians to this day start talking about Jan van Riebeck was the cause of the problems in South Africa. Well, he wasn't. He had no intention of going anywhere further than he needed to get food back to Cape Town itself to provide the ships. But with the British expansion that went northwards, then the colonies started in Africa. And then the race for the colonies, because the British were the first. Then there was the Germans, then there was the French, there was the Portuguese, Spanish. I mean, it's just amazing how many nations took parcels of land in Africa. And that is the beginning of colonization, with this battle here on the 8th of January 1806. And the ramifications are with us still today. The neglect of history continues to cause conflict in Africa and in the world. But let me just say, quote you, without their history, cultures doom themselves to remain trapped in the most illusionary tense of all, namely the present. For when trapped in the present, you become akin to a child. You know not whence you came, or whether you go. And that was from Cicero in 64 BC. So that is more than 2,000 years ago, and we are trapped in a way here. We're talking about the Battle of Blobeck. It's recently you found out about the Battle of Blobeck, and here we are today remembering this event. I mentioned to you earlier that cannon is the first sign that a battle took place here on this land. There's no sign that says Battle of Blobeck. And that's what we do as the Friends of Blobeck Conservationist, is to do the research, to prove the facts of the day or the time, and make sure the records are there. These books have been incredible to provide to the public to learn more. And I encourage anyone to, even Wikipedia has a good description of the Battle of Blobeck. But these books give us the history, what led up to it, what caused it, what was the effect after the battle. And as I say, I was talking to you about Ian van Orten, a canon.
Yes, Iquique. That's right.
This is the book that he published. He only published limited numbers, The Battle for the Cape, 1778 to 1806, as told by those who were there.
Sure. Now,
his research is incredible. His trips to Europe, to the museums and the archives, I know on one of his trips took over 30,000 photographs of documents and maps and paintings that were done. He commissioned paintings of his own for this book because there was no record He reproduced many of the scenes. Here's a scene that was produced for this book. And you can see that the wounded soldiers being brought there. There was at least 200 wounded soldiers. Now, the records are not very exact as to the deaths on that day. The British, and it was probably a propaganda thing, said only 14 British soldiers died. We know that much more than that. So this scene, the people who were used for this model were from the archaeology project.
Sure.
So when I tell my grandchildren I'm very old, well, I was there in 1806 as a surgeon. But these paintings are an incredible collection.
Beautiful.
That's a capitulation agreement when Janssen signed over the Cape Colony.
Sure.
First off, Cape Town was capitulated. Okay, von Prophiloff was in charge of the castle, and he capitulated quite quickly to save Cape Town from being involved in further conflict. That treaty was signed in Woodstock at the Treaty House, which doesn't exist now. There's no plaque or anything to indicate where it was. But then Janssen held out in Solari's Passway till he agreed on a suitable capitulation agreement where all his troops would be treated with dignity. They would be returned to Europe if they wished to return. Now, Sir David Baird, who was in charge of the British soldiers, he was well respected by the local people. He was, when he was called back to Britain because there was some issue, which is detailed in this book, the citizens of Cape Town thanked him for his service and for their treatment of the local people. At that time, there was Batavian government were imposing taxes on the farmers, for example. And there was already disharmony in what we call the Cape Colony. Swellendammers and the Kraafrenetters, they wanted to leave the control of the Batavians. Swellendam came and fought in this battle. So they obviously wanted to preserve what they had. They weren't happy about the taxes, but they wanted to preserve because they didn't know exactly what the British were going to do.
What a magnificent picture.
This is Ian Vernoort himself, dressed as a captain of the 5th Battalion Royal Artillery. But that's the kind of cannon that the Batavians were able to bring here because they had horses. The British had to use mariners off the ships to drag those cannons through the sand. Imagine there would have been 30 to 40 people involved in dragging those cannons from the beach at Melbourne Strand to the battle site.
Faith plays a big role in people's lives at different stages. Are there any mention of any of that in here?
There's a reverend that was on the British fleet, Henry Martin. I mean, he went to give blessings. He was sent to Kleinburg. There was only British officer that we know of by name, Lieutenant Foster. He was shot off his horse there, and that's where the connection comes in with Willem Steenkamp, the author of that book.
Mm-hmm.
His relative, Mormon from Swellendam, took Foster's horse to Swellendam to improve the horse breeding out there. That was his claim to fame. Whether it's 100% true, I don't know. I can't dispute it. But the fact is that Henry Martin went to all the wounded and was asking them, you know, if they wanted prayer.
Absolutely.
And he talks about a Hottentot infantryman who he went to pray over and asked him, you know, gave him the... Then he found out the guy's femur had been shattered by the musket ball and there was no saving him.
Sure.
So on the battlefield, there was people who went to the wounded to pray with them. Faith was very important at this battle. You know, there's a consequence of this battle, talking about faith, that the constitution of the Batavians, when they came back to take Cape Town, was the first time that they were allowed to the different religions. Because remember, there were a lot of people here from Java and slaves, the people who were brought here. And the British did not remove that. We started in 2016 with the 210-year anniversary, an event in January for people, especially the public, to come and see what we've found with the archaeology, what the historians can present. We did it annually until the COVID hit us, of course, and we had to stop. So in January, we try to have an event. We will do a guided walk. We have Fagasa-trained guide coming back from England to lead the walk. So Dave will be leading a small group. We have already taken bookings, but people can book. But throughout the morning and the early afternoon, we will be having presentations at Blobok Farm. There's nowhere in the reserve where we can park vehicles and a big enough venue. So we're very fortunate. We have a very good relationship with Seymour and Charmaine Curry of Blobok Farm, otherwise known as Joyce's Dairy. Indoor facilities, we will have audiovisual equipment for presentations. We will have exhibitions of the artifacts that we found. Willem Steenkamp will be there to sign his reprint.
Yeah.
We will have food and drink there. But certainly it's an annual event in January, and we do encourage the public to come and visit us. Our membership fees are very nominal. We have close to 400 members, and we focus on the heritage, as I mentioned earlier, on natural heritage and the cultural heritage of this area. Not just Blobok, but we actually involved outside of the reserve as well with those aspects. We have volunteers to go far afield to look at flowers, identify flowers on farms, to see where these critically endangered wildflowers are. We have to preserve and protect those, and as you were asking about collection of seeds to reintroduce into the nature reserve, we have to go outside, we have to get landowners' permission, we have to get a permit to collect seeds and cuttings. There's a lot of research been going on for, as I say, for more than 10 years about why certain species have not, even when the seeds are planted, they don't thrive.
Strange, yeah.
So there's lots of things we need to understand about this fynbos. It took hundreds of thousands of years to establish itself in this inhospitable landscape we live in. But we have the Cape Floristic Kingdom is the only floristic kingdom in the world that exists in one country. And Cape Town has the most threatened species in the world of any city. And we're losing tens of species a year throughout South Africa through development. Let's call it that. Whether it's residential development or whether it's agricultural development or industrial development. And once they've gone, they've gone. All our seeds, by the way, you know, are a sample of them are sent to the World Seed Bank. So those are in, I believe it's Norway, in a underground, to preserve those seeds forever. So the world will know that that seed was here. So I was able to get the custodians of rare endangered wildflowers from Tigerberg Hills Friends Group to come. And after their first walk, they said, no, this is a rich diversity of plant species here. And I encouraged them to come every month. And over a year, we were able to establish which flowers flowered in which particular time of the year. And we produced our first guidebook. We've now published the second one. We will be producing further ones. We've got enough research done. It's just time for our volunteers to actually produce the script for the photograph and to lay it out. And so there will be further two books, one on Rhinosterfeld, which is on Blobok Hill, and the Sand Plain Fynbos, which is that big restoration site.
It's really a privilege to have been here and to actually speak about these amazing things. And we want to take you guys back to connect with the friends of the Blobok Conservation Area and go onto their website, see what's happening there and get involved. Looking at the Battle of Blobok with everything that we listened to today, brave people like Henry Martin, the Anglican priest, so many brave men that gave their lives, over 700 killed according to a British commander. And the irony of it all is that 189 were wounded, 15 killed and 36 drowned even before the battle started. Looking back at all of this, it's important to remember, celebrate history and the bravery of each and every one of them on the battlefield, fighting for the cause that they believed in. So het ons saam gekuier hier vandag in Op Pad met Gilma. Pad gevat ons daar op die N7 het ons by die natuurreservaat gaan stilhou en ek hoop dat jy dit ook baie interessant gevind het. Belangrike geskiedenis wat ons Kaap en ons land permanent beïnvloed het. Belangrike inligting wat die geskiedenis van Suid-Afrika radikaal verander het met die slag van Blouberg. Wie sy nou kon dink nie? Laat my weet as jy wil hê ons moet by jou kom besoek aflê. Stuur e-pos vir ons by gilma@kpulpit.co.za of andersins kan jy vir ons skakel 021-9177-000 en dan kan jy net vir ons laat weet en sê jy wil hê ons moet by jou kom kuier. En wie weet, ons stop dalk binnenkort daar voor jou deur. Dankie vir jou saamluister. Onthou die program word Sondag herhaal tussen 1 en 3 en dan is hy ook op Potgooi beskikbaar.
Hierdie inset was aan jou gebring met die komplimente van Radio Kaapse Kansel 729 AM. Besoek ons gerus by www.capepulpit.co.za.